Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm in 1 Kings chapter 4. I'm going to do the whole chapter today, 34 verses. Our context is this. In our last chapter, Solomon had gone to Hebron and asked, not Hebron, I'm sorry, gone to Gibeon and asked for wisdom. God gave it to him because he had not asked for things for himself, but he had asked for wisdom to be a good ruler for the people of Israel. And as an example of his wisdom, we were given the famous story of the two prostitutes who were trying to decide whose son was whose. And Solomon said, cut him in two. And so the real mother said, oh, she can have him, she can have him. I don't want him, because she wanted the baby to live, which then indicated to Solomon that who the real mother was. And that, of course, story made Solomon famous everywhere. Just one example of his wisdom. We're going to see more examples of it in chapter 4. We start now in 1 Kings 4, verses 1 through 6. Now, this is a list of a lot of officials, and this could be quite boring if I let it be. I'll try not to let it be. We read verses 1 through 6. So King Solomon ruled over all Israel. Now, ruling over all Israel, not many kings of Israel ever did that. Saul did. David ruled only of his 40-year reign. 7 years of that was taken up with ruling Judah alone in Hebron by itself without the other northern tribes of Israel. So David didn't rule over the whole of Israel all during his reign. Solomon did. Then after Solomon died, the split between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Kingdom was split ever since. So Solomon, as we are going to see here, was a very powerful king. Not just because he ruled over all Israel, but because he ruled over the whole ancient Middle East, basically. I shouldn't say over the whole ancient Near East, but he was the most powerful king in the ancient Near East. Verse 2, and these were his chief officials, Azariah, son of Zadok the priest. He's mentioned as being the grandson of Zadok the priest. In Chronicles, of course, son and grandson means the same thing. It means descendant. Just depends on the translation. Zadok is the famous high priest that Saul had appointed as high priest in his kingdom when David took Abiathar and fled to the wilderness from Saul's persecution. So Zadok's the priest. Azariah's probably the prime minister, because he's mentioned first, as Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown say. It doesn't matter, really, because nobody knows anything about this guy. And then David's secretary, or secretaries, was the sons of Shisha. Shisha is Sheva, who was David's secretary. His two sons, Elihoreph and Ahijah, inherited the office. They were secretaries of Solomon. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was the recorder. That's the historian, historiographer, if you will, who chronicled the affairs of the kingdom. That's the same man that served under David. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, I'm sure you know about already, because he is the head of the Kerethites and Pelethites, a special military unit in Israel, perhaps bodyguards, and he was the one that had taken over from Joab once Solomon executed Joab, and so Benaiah ended up being the commander-in-chief, as it says here in verse 4. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. They were the two priests that were appointed by David when David took over the United Kingdom of Israel. He had Abiathar with him already, and Zadok was already high priest when Saul was there. And so, as a political move, David said, okay, we're going to have two high priests, Zadok from the Benjaminites of Saul and Abiathar from the Judahites, my neck of the woods. And so there were two high priests, Zadok and Abiathar. Now, of course, Abiathar is later deposed by Solomon, ending the line of Ithamar. Abiathar is of the line of Ithamar, and the line of Ithamar was, shall we say, cursed. I don't know if cursed might be too strong a word, but was predicted by God to be wiped out because Eli was of the line of Abiathar, and his sons were profaning the temple, having sex with concubines, or sex with women at the doorway of the temple, and so forth. So later on, 1 Kings 2:27, Solomon banished Abiathar from being the Lord's priest, and it fulfilled the Lord's prophecy he had spoken at Shiloh against Eli's family. That was a good almost 100 years before. God said, the priesthood is going to be taken out of your family, Eli, and his family was Ithamar, because of all the sin in his family. So Solomon, probably not willingly, probably didn't even think about it when he did it, but he got rid of Abiathar. And that was, of course, we've already read about that, because Abiathar went with Adonijah in the rebellion at the beginning of the kingdom. When David died, Adonijah tried to take the kingdom in advance of Solomon. So Abiathar eventually is bye-bye, gone. Zadok is the high priest. Now we have Azariah, son of Nathan, in charge of the district officers. We're going to talk about the district officers in just a minute in the next several verses, or the deputies as one translation has it. We'll hold that for right now. Then we've got Zabud, son of Nathan. Zabud was a priest and personal advisor to the king. The KJV says he was the king's friend. All kings need friends, and they all need advisors. Presidents to this day have advisors. Verse 6, Ahishar in charge of the palace. He was the steward taking care of that big palace that Solomon had that we're going to read about eventually as we keep moving. And then we've got Adoniram, son of Abda, in charge of forced labor. Now, the King James has in charge of tribute here. Now, what he did is he received and brought into the treasury all the proceeds of taxes and tributes. I like that, forced labor and tributes. Tributes is forced money, and forced labor is forced labor, and both of them together end up with, as the libertarians like to say, slavery. This is getting taxes and manual labor from countries that Solomon ended up conquering, and they paid him tribute. Now, this guy Adoniram was also in charge of forced labor or tribute under David. We read that in 2 Samuel 20, verse 24. Now, most of the modern translations don't have tribute like the King James have. They have forced labor. Adoniram was in charge of forced labor. Green's literal translation even says forced labor. So one of my commentators says that this word here that's translated as forced labor is not the collection of money or goods, but the levy of compulsory laborers. And most of the modern translations tend to agree with that. So anyway, it doesn't really matter. The point is that Solomon had slaves. Remember, they had no POW camps back then. You conquer somebody, you make them a slave, you make them work for you. That's your penalty for losing the war. We go now to 1 Kings 4, 7 through 19. Verse 7, Solomon had 12 deputies for all Israel. The NIV has district governors, which I like better. These district governors provided food for the king and his household. Each one made provision for 1 month out of the year. Now, I mentioned it when I was reading verse 5 that Azariah, the son of Nathan, was in charge of these deputies, in charge of these district governors. Now, the first question I had was, well, does this correspond to the 12 tribes of Israel? Ellicott answers that eloquently for me in the negative. Ellicott says this, quote, "This denotes the collection of revenue, mostly no doubt in kind, for the maintenance of the court and household and guards of the king." Now, Ellicott says they collected revenue. That sounds like money to me, but he says collecting revenue in kind. Revenue is not in kind. Now, maybe that's ancient English. I don't know. But basically what he's saying is these 12 district officers collected animals to feed the king for the maintenance of the court, and perhaps may have included also the management of the royal domain lands, such as described under David's reign in 1 Chronicles 26. The office must have been of high importance and dignity, for in two cases, this is in verse 11 and verse 15 in our passage here, which I'll read in just a minute, the holders of it were married into the royal house. So two of these 12 district officers were married into King Solomon's family. Now the provinces over which they had authority, 9 on the west and 3 on the east of Jordan, coincide only in a few cases with the lands assigned to the several tribes. So the 12 districts here are not the same as the 12 tribes. It is not unlikely that by this time much of the tribal division of territory had become obsolete, although we see from 1 Chronicles 27, 16 through 22 that for chieftainship over men and for levy in war, it still remained in force. So the 12 tribal divisions are good for mustering the army, but not for providing food for the king's household. And we'll see in just a little bit, it's a whole heap of food that they had to supply. Now, the names of the 12 are given here, and I'm not going to bore you by reading these names. One of them, interestingly, is Ben-Hur. One of them, Ben-Abinadab, was married to Tapheth, daughter of Solomon. And another one of these 12 was Ahimaaz of Naphtali. He was married to Basemath, who was a daughter of Solomon. Other than that, their names have been lost to history, except for being printed here, and I don't really care anymore about that. It's mentioned in verse 19, there was one deputy or one district governor in the land of Judah, in charge of Judah. Now, Adam Clark says that providing food was not easy. They had to do it once a month. And, of course, the provisions were in kind. They had to actually get the animals to Solomon's palace, and that could be very laborious. Now, when we get down here and look at how many people might have possibly been in Solomon's royal court, we will see it was a monstrous amount of people, which means that the animals required was a monstrous amount of animals. So this was an honor, all right, but it was also a pain to be in charge of these districts. We go down to verses 20 and 21 of 1 Kings 4, and I'm going to say right here, these two verses play in a huge theological controversy. So we need to remember these two, 1 Kings 4, 20 through 21. You need to have those sort of memorized in your brain. Verse 20, the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river, that's the Euphrates River, to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. Now, verse 20 says, the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand of the seashore. That should call to mind that famous covenant promise that God had made to Abraham. That's one of which examples of this is in Genesis 22:17. God is speaking to Abraham, and he says, indeed, I will greatly bless you, Abraham, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. In other words, your descendants are going to be innumerable and uncountable. Your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. Well, that very famous covenant promise is fulfilled right here, because in 1 Kings 4:20 we see that the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Fulfillment. Now, this fulfillment is a type of better things which is going to come to the spiritual Israel, i.e. the church, Hosea 1:10. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it will come about that in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. So that prophecy is talking about the fulfillment in the church. There's going to be so many Christians, you can't even count them, which is about what we've got today, actually. So the people drank and they were happy. Now Adam Clark rains a little bit on the parade of the Israelites here. He says, quote, they were comfortable, very rich, very merry, and very corrupt. And this full feeding and dissipation led to a total corruption of manners. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Adam Clark was exactly right. Now verse 21 says, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. Now this verse, verse 21, is going to show how God's covenant promise to Abraham concerning the land is fulfilled. Verse 20 was how God's covenant promise to Abraham concerning the offspring of Abraham were fulfilled, or the seed or the descendants of Abraham. Two aspects of the same covenant promise. So let's look at the land promise here in verse 21. From the river, that's the Euphrates River, that's in the northeast of the kingdom, right button up on Syria. It's in Syria, the Euphrates River. The land of the Philistines is to the west, the Shephelah, the coastlands there, southwest of Jerusalem, well, west and southwest of Jerusalem, that's where the Philistines lived. And then as far as the border of Egypt, you go south to the Wadi El Arish, that is the little wadi that comes out of the Mediterranean, southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea, and runs southeast or so in that general direction, and that divides Egypt from Israel. So basically, that's the outline of the kingdom from the extremes of the northeast to the extreme end at the southwest. Solomon ruled over all that. Well, that shows that he fulfilled the offspring promise to, the land promise to Abraham. Let's read that in Genesis 15:18. This is the famous occasion where God met with Abraham and made the famous covenant with him, Genesis 15:18. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, I give this land to your offspring. And then he describes the land from the brook of Egypt, that's the Wadi El Arish, to the Euphrates River, that's the river. The same geographical markings that are given in the covenant promise in Genesis 15:18, it's been fulfilled here by Solomon. So Solomon was a great king. He fulfilled the promises to Abraham. There's another relevant scripture referring to this in Psalm 72:8, which reads this, may he, referring to Solomon, may he also rule from sea to sea. That would be from the Mediterranean Sea over to the Dead Sea. And from the river, that's the Euphrates River, to the ends of the earth, or the ends of the land, Eretz is land, to the end of the land, that would be the Wadi El Arish. And so Solomon's occupation of the land and fulfillment of the land promised to Abraham is given poetic a claim here in Psalm 72, verse 8. Now, of course, all of this are types of the great antitype, the fulfillment of the shadows. The fulfillment of the shadows is the church of Jesus Christ, Hebrews 4, 3. For we who have believed, that's Christians, enter the rest, and of course rest is the typical word for entering the promised land. You read that everywhere in the Old Testament. For we who have believed, enter the rest, enter the land, in keeping with what he has said. So I swore in my anger, they will not enter my rest, and they will not enter my land. That's because God was mad at the Israelites. And yet his works have been finished since the foundation of the world. And of course his works is the church. So all of this stuff in the Old Testament is for the New Testament church, and the types are there. The land is a type of Christ's universal rule. Now in verse 21, it says that Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. These countries brought tribute. Well, that would be, the kingdoms would be any Canaanite tribe that's in the area. But also, he also ruled over other countries that brought tribute. As Adam Clark says, the kingdoms of Syria, which is to the northeast, Damascus, well, that is the Syrian kingdom, really. They were divided. The Aram, Assyria, was divided into little kinglets, little sub-kingdoms, if you will, but we just call them Syria. And then we've got Moab brought tribute. That's the pagan nation that is to the east of the northern half of the Dead Sea, and Ammon is north of Moab. They also brought tribute to Solomon. They are to the east of Gilead, which is the area east of the Jordan River, east of the tribe of Gad. And so Adam Clark says this, quote, "Thus he, Solomon, appears to have possessed all the land that God covenanted with Abraham to give to his posterity." Well, that would seem straight enough. However, because of a very strong theological tradition in America, which I don't agree with, dispensationalism, the dispensationalists say, no, all of this fulfillment is not in Solomon. The fulfillment is in a millennial kingdom of Israel that's going to happen at the end of time before Jesus comes back, or which is established at the time that Jesus comes back the first time, then he's going to come back a second time, all of which I utterly disagree with. But I will say this, if that is true, that would be a second fulfillment, because it's clear here that the land promises and the offspring promises to Abraham were fulfilled in Solomon. It's at least clear to anybody that's clear thinking, I think. It's just obvious. Now, some dispensationalists try to get around that by saying, well, all these kingdoms and tribes and people that are bringing tribute to Solomon, they weren't really ruled by Solomon. They were just bringing tribute. In other words, Solomon hadn't taken over the government and the governments and put his officials in charge. To which I say, that is utter nonsense. If a nation is bringing you tribute, you got them. That's the way they worked back then in the ancient Near East. Assyria, you're going to say, well, Assyria didn't really conquer all of the nations that Assyria conquered because they were just bringing tribute. That's the way Assyria did things. It would be stupid to say that. It'd be foolish to say that. Well, I think this is a foolish thought. I don't know if all dispensationalists take this tack, but if they do, if a dispensationalist does that, I would just immediately say to him, that's nonsense. If the countries are bringing tribute to Solomon, that means Solomon's in charge and the promise is fulfilled, the land promise. Now, what dispensationalists could say is that, well, it was fulfilled by Solomon here, but it's going to be fulfilled a second time. And I've had dispensationalists tell me that all the time, and to which I say, fine, speculate all you want. I can't prove you wrong, so I'm not going to waste time speculating with you. I can't prove you wrong, but you can't prove me wrong either, because we don't know what the future's going to hold. So if sometime in the future it all gets fulfilled in a Jewish millennial kingdom, I will take you out, buy you a hamburger, and say you were right. I doubt very seriously that's going to happen, but it could. We go now to 1 Kings 4, verse 22 through 28. Solomon's provisions for one day were 150 bushels of fine flour and 300 bushels of meal, 10 fattened oxen, 20 range oxen, and 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and pen-fed poultry. I told you, these 12 officials in charge of bringing food to Solomon's palace, they were tasked with a very, very heavy duty indeed. Verse 24, 4, because he had dominion over everything west of the Euphrates. In other words, because he was a big shot, his palace was big, he had a lot of officials there, and therefore it took a whole lot of animals to feed them. So let's see where he has dominion over everything west of the Euphrates. If you look at the map, which I have here, the Euphrates River runs up from just above the Persian Gulf, It's the westernmost of the two rivers, Euphrates and Tigris, which border the Mesopotamian Valley. You come up the Euphrates River. That river is constantly moving northwest until it gets up to Syria. When you get to the Syria is that land present day, even to this day, which is north of Lebanon, to the east of the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea. So that's Syria. So if you go to Israel and just veer a little bit to the northeast, you're going to bump up against Damascus, and then you're going to hit the Euphrates River. So if you look at the Euphrates River, you will see going up far to the north as the river comes down from the mountains up there, Carchemish, famous place of a lot of ancient battles. We'll mention Carchemish when we get to the Babylonian battles against Assyria and Israel. But if you go about 60 miles south of Carchemish on the Euphrates River, you get to Tifsa, which is mentioned here. Tifsa is about 60 miles or so due east of Aleppo, the famous Aleppo, which is in Syria. So Tifsa is right there on the Euphrates River. So let me read what Easton's Dictionary says about Tifsa. Well, let me go back and read verse 24 here. For Solomon had dominion over everything west of the Euphrates from Tifsa to Gaza. Now, Gaza, of course, is at the far southwestern edge of Israel. Right there as the Mediterranean Sea starts its southeastern bend as it makes the southeastern bend of the river there, of the sea there. Same where Gaza is today. And Tifsa's way up here on the Euphrates River. And, of course, that shows that Solomon has a huge jurisdiction here. A huge dominion, and over all the kings west of the Euphrates. Easton's Dictionary says that Tifsa is one of the boundaries of Solomon's dominions, of course, as we just read. It's a great and wealthy town on the western bank of the Euphrates. All the land traffic between the east and the west passed through it, so it's an important city. Menachem, one of the northern kings of Israel, undertook an expedition against this city and smote Tifsa and all that were therein. We'll get to that in 2 Kings chapter 15. And Easton's finishes up by saying that Tifsa was practically a defiance to Assyria, which was, of course, weak during the time of Solomon. So Solomon was a big shot. So let's go back to our verse here. All of these animals are taken or required every day to feed the palace for, verse 24, because he had dominion over everything. In other words, because he had such a dominion, he had such a big court, he had to feed it. He had peace on all his surrounding borders, verse 24 says. Throughout Solomon's reign, Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan to Beersheba. That's the standard formulation of north to south in Israel. Dan being up near Caesarea Philippi in the time of Jesus. In that general area down to Beersheba, which is famous in patriarchal history, about halfway between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, about two-thirds of the way from the northern tip of the Dead Sea. From Dan to Beersheba, each man under his own vine and his own fig tree. You don't need fortified walls if you're living under your own vine. You're not within fortified walls living under your own vine, which means there was peace. Now, let's look at some of the estimates of the people that were fed by all these 10 fattened oxen every day, twin range oxen, 100 sheep, deer, gazelle, roebucks, not to mention the 150 bushels of fine flour and 300 bushels of meal. How many people would it take to eat up all that stuff? Well, I found in one of my commentators various estimates, and they range fairly widely, but let me read them to you. 29,160, 48,600, 54,000, 60,000, 70,000. Well, that's a lot of people. Let's just take the most conservative estimate of roughly 29,000 people. 29,000 people in his court? Yowza! We go now to verse 26. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Now, 40,000 is a problem here. Before I get into that problem, I failed to omit in verse 2 address this phrase in verse 23, 10 fattened oxen as opposed to 20 range oxen. A fattened oxen is an oxen that was put in the stall in order to be fattened, just like we have today. 20 range oxen, they were just left to eat the natural grass. They're not quite as fat and juicy. But at any rate, let's move now from the food that they ate to the horses that Solomon had. And of course, horses for chariots, this is for warfare. Well, let's look at the number 40,000. That seems like an awful big number. 2 Chronicles 9:25 says he has 4,000 stalls of horses. So how do we reconcile 40,000 with 4,000? Well, the easiest way is a copyist error. Jai Gill says that it was 40,000, but the stalls mentioned in 1 Kings here is a stall that had 10 horses each, so it was 4,000 times 10 for a total of 40,000 horses. 2 Chronicles says the stalls, let me read that, 2 Chronicles 9:25, Solomon had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen. He stationed them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. And so Gill says there were 4,000 stalls in Jerusalem, but there were 36,000 stalls elsewhere, or 40,000 total stalls in the whole kingdom. All of that's, I don't know, I think that's sucking air. I think it's just a copyist error. Now this, all these horses, however many of them they were, let's say they're 4,000 horses, that's a lot of horses. And these horses were a symbol of earthly military power that Solomon wasn't supposed to rely on. Let's read some of these famous scriptures. Deuteronomy 17:16. However, he, the king, must not acquire many horses for himself or send the people back to Egypt to acquire many horses, for the Lord has told you, you are never to go back that way again. Egypt, of course, was famous for all its horses, and God did not want the people to rely on Egyptian military power. Isaiah 31:1. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and who depend on horses. They trust in the abundance of chariots and in the large number of horsemen. Are you listening, Solomon? They do not look to the Holy One of Israel, and they do not seek the Lord's help. I wonder if Isaiah was thinking back to Solomon when he wrote that. This was about 300 years later, but I wonder if he did. Psalm 20:7. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. Of course, this is probably also referring to Solomon. Nothing wrong with having a strong military, but if you trust in that military and don't trust in Yahweh, nothing wrong with having a lot of money, but if you trust in that money instead of God, nothing wrong with having a beautiful, wonderful wife, but if you trust in her instead of God, you are toast. And we'll see that Solomon really screwed up his rule as we go on. Despite all the natural advantages he had, his power, his wealth, his wisdom. Verse 25 says that throughout Solomon's reign, Judah and Israel lived in safety. At John Gill, who loves type, says, this safety is a type of Christian safety in Christ. I don't believe it is. Gill, I think, is type happy. It's not one of those obvious types. There are lots of types in the Old Testament, but I like the ones that are sort of clear, like Exodus, like Abraham putting Isaac up on Mount Moriah. We go now to 1 Kings 4:29-34, and we will finish this chapter. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight, and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other man, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proproverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also taught about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. Now of all the men of the East, Solomon was wiser than them, and the East was famous for its wisdom. That wisdom, of course, was gotten through divination, soothsaying, stargazing, in other words, demonic-type activity, but Solomon was bigger than all that. He was greater and more wise than all the people of Egypt. Egypt was also famous for wisdom. Moses was well-skilled in it, Acts 7:22, and Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. In fact, in later times, later than where we are now, the philosophers of the Gentiles traveled to Egypt to get knowledge. Pythagoras, Anaxagoras, Plato, this is, what, 400 or 500 years? Let's see, Plato is maybe 300 years B.C. Anaxagoras is maybe 500, I can't remember, some B.C. in that area. Herodotus, I think, was 500 B.C. This is after where we are now. We are around 1,000 or so B.C. But still, in those later times, people went to Egypt, and Egypt was said to be the mother of arts and sciences. In fact, Alexandria, the famous northern city that was founded by Alexander the Great, it had its world-famous library that got burned down and destroyed much of the wisdom of the ancient world. Egypt's famous for wisdom. The Septuagint was translated there. Solomon was greater than all of that. Of course, that didn't exist in the time of Solomon, but whatever wisdom that existed in Egypt, let's put it that way, Solomon was bigger than that. And then some individual wise men are mentioned who have been lost to history. Ethan the Ezrahite, don't know who he is. Heman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal, are mentioned. Heman, as Jamin Fawcett and Brown say, that he was the chief of the temple musicians and the king's seers, the king's prophets. That's in 1 Chronicles 25:5. So, in other words, Solomon is wiser than his own prophets. Now, these three, Heman, Calcol, and Darda, are said to be the sons of Mahal. In Chronicles, they're said to be the sons of Zerah. So either Mahal and Zerah are two different people, or either they're the same person with two different names, or it could be Mahal should be translated here as, or not Mahal, excuse me, the three sons, Heman, Calcol, and Darda, should be translated as music, piping, and dancing. I hope I've got that right. That's from John Gill. It doesn't really matter. But apparently Solomon, I mean, he was into songs and music. Verse 32, he spoke 3,000 proverbs. We have a lot of them in the book of Proverbs. His songs numbered 1,005. We only have one, the Song of Solomon, but people are still reading it to this day. Unfortunately, I think a lot of them are single Christian guys who like all that sexual stuff in there. And they say, well, we can read it in the Bible and it's okay. But at any rate, he had 1,005 songs. He described plant life. He was a botanist. He also taught about animals, birds, reptiles, and fish. That would make him a zoologist. Plant life from the cedar of Lebanon. Of course, that's the famous cedar forest that Hiram, king of Tyre, or maybe Hiram, father and son, kings of Tyre, provided the Israelites to build that famous temple of Solomon. Hyssop, of course, is used in the Old Testament rituals for cleansing. I've got a picture of hyssop. It's kind of a medicinal aromatic herb that's spongy, that soaks up liquid, and it's purple in all the pictures that I have. I hope that's the same hyssop they had back in Israel. I don't know, but at any rate, I like to look at something, and it says hyssop that grows out of walls. Apparently, it, like ivy, grows out of walls. Now, all this wisdom doesn't even mention the wisdom that Solomon had as far as his judicial exploits. Remember, deciding the case of the two prostitutes with the one live baby. Whose baby is it? I mean, Solomon was really something. He was the Aristotle of the second millennium B.C. He really was. A lot of his stuff got lost, unfortunately. We don't have 3,000 Proverbs and 1,005 Psalms. Could have gotten lost in the Babylonian captivity, but I bet if it had been preserved, he'd be right up there with Aristotle. Verse 34, men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom. That all has three possible translations or three possible meanings. All meaning in a whole lot of, a whole heap of. Two, all nations without exception, which is nonsense. Not men of all nations would come to listen to Solomon. That's impossible. Or it could mean all nations without distinction. There's no distinction to be made here. No distinction to deny. So it means men of a whole bunch of nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom. John Gill says of this, quote, it was reported that Solomon wrote a book of medicines for all diseases, which was fixed to the entrance of the temple, which Hezekiah, the later king, took away, because sick people applied to that book for cure of their disorders and neglected to pray to God. That's something. His medicine was so well known. So he was a doctor, too. He was a polymath of the first order. Jameson, Foss, and Brown say that his Proverbs and his Song of Solomon, those two books, were not lost because they were inspired, because God didn't want them to get lost. I don't doubt that for a minute. Verse 33, Solomon's knowledge of animals made him the first natural historian in the world, as Adam Clark says. Not just animals, but also the plant life. But unfortunately for science, all his works were lost, as well as his non-scientific works. They were lost. Well, anyway, we have an interesting insight into the nature of this fabulous King Solomon here in chapter 4, and we are now ready to go to chapter 5, verses 1 through 18, and we will look at preparations for building his famous Solomon's Temple. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.